Thank you, Maple. So kind of shifting chairs around here. So the Northwestern Wildcat football game is not going to be on WGN Radio. Just to be clear, you can hear it at WGNRadio.com. We've moved it over to AM 1000 today to accommodate, as Joe said, a matinee hockey game. They're on the East Coast, 1 o'clock there, noon here, 11:30, our pregame coverage on WGN Radio. So we got about 90 minutes to spend together this morning. Happy to have you on board. Remember, the Mincing Rascals podcast dropped on Thursday, and we'll broadcast part of the podcast, as we always do, between 11 and 11:30. One quick note about something that's going on this morning in Indiana, and a lot of you may be, well, probably there already, or at least know a little bit about it. There's going to be a crowd of 11,000 people gathering. Now, the scheduled time was 10 o'clock, so they're probably doing it right now. This morning, 11,000 people are gathering at the, what do they call this particular location? Navy officials say the $450 million new combat ship, the USS Indianapolis, is going to be commissioned at 10 o'clock this morning at the Port of Indiana in Burns Harbor. It's the fourth ship to bear the USS Indianapolis name. That's a famous name, isn't it? 74 years ago, that ship sunk, and it's that famous story where after World War II was essentially about to end, we'd already dropped the atomic bombs, and within days, the war is going to end. The Indianapolis is making its way back. It's still hit by a torpedo. The men are in the water, and the sharks get them. The sharks get them. It's a terrible story. And the Tribune had a story by Carol Carlson about Richard Thielen, who was then an 18-year-old gunner's mate on the cruiser Indianapolis, vaulted into the air when a Japanese tornado sank his ship July 30th, 1945. He said to the Tribune, "I remember mostly how quickly it sunk. I had to stay alive out there. Every time I was ready to give up, I felt my dad's grip, and I saw his face. There were 1,200 sailors on that ship, and only 317 survived. He was afloat 5 days in the Pacific. Some died of dehydration. Others were killed by sharks. It was the biggest loss of life in the Navy's history. The ship sank just 4 days after delivering components of the nuclear bomb Little Boy that was dropped on Hiroshima. The captain survived but was court-martialed soon afterwards. Authorities say he was guilty of endangering the vessel because he didn't steer a zigzag course to avoid the torpedoes. The captain was haunted by that tragedy. He took his own life in 1968. Bill Clinton exonerated him in the year 2000. Thielen thinks he survived the sharks because he was saturated with diesel fuel, and he didn't think the sharks liked the smell. I saw one man taken by a shark 15 feet away. I felt one bump my legs and my life jacket." So he survived that Indianapolis disaster. The new Indianapolis was built, what, in Wisconsin they build these things, and then they sail them down into Lake Michigan. This one will eventually make its way down to Florida, and the new Indianapolis will be a boat that looks for mines and destroys mines. That's how it's going to be deployed. 70 officers and enlisted sailors will be on a ship that can go 40 knots, very agile, not as big as some boats, but 388 feet long is the Indianapolis in Burns Harbor. It's built in Marionette, Wisconsin. And they wanted to have the christening in Indiana because the steel mills are over there that generated the plates that made the ship. So it's a touching and fitting place, both with it being named Indianapolis and the folks in Indiana having a lot to do with the actual construction of it. So congratulations and Godspeed to all of the people over there at Burns Harbor. 11,000 people gather there today. I posted on my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John on Facebook, 32 movies. It was actually a link from Esquire magazine. It's the 32, oh yeah, before we do this, Griff, let's resolve that since it's on the top of my mind. Lou Manfredini and I were expressing our outrage at the fact that Lou got charged $2 for an ice cube in his Manhattan last night. Lou and I like us a good Manhattan. I can just see him sitting there. And what did he say? It cost $12, but it was $14 because they charged him $2 for rocks. And his buddy had a couple. And so that was two plus two. So they had $6 of ice charges. We did not mention the restaurant in our conversation. Maybe just as well. Griff, what are people texting to you?
We had a few calls, and I'm looking it up now, and I see a few things about this that at many places, I feel silly saying this. Maybe people are like, duh, probably screaming at the radio. But
no, because that's my go-to drink. I've had a few Manhattans out.
All right, let me read just a brief thing from, this is from vitalvegas.com. Okay. So you know it's the good info. But there are a bunch of places that have written on this, and they seem to be an authority on things like this. When a customer orders a liquor on the rocks, it's standard to pour an extra half ounce of liquor. The standard pour is 1.5. Drinks on the rocks contain 2 ounces. So that's a $3 additional charge. Or I guess it depends on the place, but some additional charge for the liquor, not the ice. So they call it a rocks bump, but it's the charge is for the liquor.
I see. Okay.
I don't know if this is actually what happened to Lou, but it seems applicable.
I've never run into that. I've ordered me a Manhattan on the rocks before, and my wife will sometimes get a cocktail straight up, and I've never seen it broken down that way. Where well, you have the ice cube, you have it straight.
We had a few calls saying this, and then there's plenty of reading you could do online if you Google this. I'm scrolling right now.
I don't know that I want to read about ice and cocktails, but I've just not noticed that. Although there is this little debate when they put the drinks down in front of you, and that is, I wonder who gets more booze here, because my ice seems to take up more space. So you think, oh, I'll get it neat, straight up, say, and then I won't have to pay for the ice. I'll get more alcohol. In this case, it seems like they make a point to give you more alcohol with the ice and then make it a quote-unquote rocks charge, which is bad business. Just charge $14 and hide the cost. That's my business. That's my suggestion to them.
It's, I don't know. Yeah.
Here we go now. 32 scariest movies to watch on Netflix right now. This is an article in Esquire. I posted it on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John. I like the list because there's movies that are on Netflix that maybe you just don't know that well. Scream is on there. Cult of Chucky is on there. You've heard of those. Tusk is on there. I watched a lot of Tusk this morning.
You did?
Oh, my God. Is that a creepy movie? Wow.
I can't believe you watched
that
Tusk.
That movie is out of its mind. All I'll say this is...
This is the Kevin Smith movie, right?
Scary Walrus.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my word. Tusk.
I'm glad you liked it. I don't know if I feel the same way, but
why don't you like it? It's scary. It's creepy. It's out there. It's bizarro.
Maybe it's worth revisiting.
In the Tall Grass is in there, which gets on some people's list. This is a Netflix list. New scary movies you should watch now. Insidious, AMI, Candyman. Have you watched Candyman?
Candyman is a Chicago classic.
Is that a good movie? I don't know that I know it.
It is set in Chicago, early 90s, and it's being remade... produced, not directed, but produced by Jordan Peele of Get Out.
Oh, wow.
And Us.
Wow.
So that's coming back.
Would you rather...
That's a very good movie.
The Black Coat's Daughter, Emily, The Velvet Buzzsaw. Well, there's a name for a scary movie. The
Velvet Buzzsaw came out earlier this year. It's a Netflix original.
Yeah.
I didn't love it. It's about an evil painting.
Yeah, right. Oh, I get it. Velvet.
It would be... It's a cool idea. It's this painting that kills everybody that comes in contact with it, basically. But it didn't really work for me.
I like that. The Monster, XX, Bird Box, Cam,
Bird Box.
Christine, The Conjuring, Creep. There's a movie called Hush.
Yeah, I mean, I think Netflix stockpiles these horror movies, and there's a bunch of dreck. They're just
right.
They just want a bunch just to give you options. And then there are some good ones in there.
Yeah, The Sixth Sense is on there.
Sure.
Which so in looking at that, though, I found a better list. This is the Cosmo 40 Scariest Movies of All Time list. Came out this month, of course. And everybody does this. But I'm telling you, I was clicking around last night. My wife and I came upon 28 Days Later with Cillian Murphy. Who plays...
He's in Peaky Blinders.
Tommy... I wrote his name down, and now I don't see it in front
Shelby?
Of me. Tommy Shelby in Peaky Blinders.
I'm just into the Peaky Blinders game.
Isn't that a terrific film?
Yeah, I'm hooked.
Or series?
One season and I'm hooked. I was listening to the soundtrack the other day.
Wow, you know you're into it then.
Yeah.
So that guy, Cillian Murphy from Peaky Blinders, the star of that, is one of the stars of this movie, 28 Days Later. By the way, the first season of Peaky Blinders, three of the episodes were directed by the guy who just made this movie, The Aeronauts, with Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones. The Aeronauts is a movie about ballooning in the 1860s. And it's a good movie, really fun movie, really good movie. So he was telling us about Peaky Blinders, too.
Well, you just talked to him.
Yeah, I just talked to him Thursday. He was in our studio. He was here for the premiere of the movie, and then we talked about the movie and then Peaky Blinders, too. He said that Peaky Blinders is based on the guy's life, not his life, but it's the legends and the stories of his family. And when they gave him some of the scripts back, he goes, yeah, this really isn't close enough to our family. So as they're shooting the first season, they're rewriting as they go. He said, we would sometimes get the scripts that day. They would say, okay, here's how you're going to shoot the movie or this episode. No, you're not. You're going to shoot it this way. Do it this way. Peaky Blinders is so good. It is so detailed. It is so violent. I always ask filmmakers, I don't talk to them that often, but when I get a chance, I say, what was it like on the set when the one guy kicked the snot out of the other guy or cut his arm off or shot him in the face or just all sorts of violence in this show, right? What is it like on the set? Do you high-five each other because you nailed it, or do you apologize to each other? He said after some of those scenes, it's quiet. He said, we actually don't think the violence is gratuitous. We try to be respectful to what just happened here, so they're not elbowing each other, saying, good one. It must be a very weird thing to pour that much emotion and that much violence out and then just pause and then move on to something else. But it sounds like that's what they do. I want to go back to scary movies for just a second. But before I do, one other note about the movie that this guy made called The Aeronauts. Griffith's about, you know, ballooning. So they actually built a balloon like they made in the 1800s. And then they launched it into the air, 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
Felicity Jones is in the balloon. She is actually like Tom Cruise climbing around the gondola, the wicker basket, moving around as they're shooting it from a helicopter that's hovering nearby. So I say to the guy, how is it that you're able to get the dialogue? Like, you've got a long lens in the helicopter. I see how you can shoot it. How is it that you're actually able to hear them talking? He says, oh, well, you can't. They do the lines. Then they go back into the studio and they lip sync the lines. Much of this, I said, you've got to be kidding me. He said, a lot of movies are done that way. Because of all the extraneous noise, they just lip-sync them afterwards. Boy, are they good at that. It's 10:22. Okay, so the Cosmo list of movies that you should watch for fun after this. Joe Brand, are you a scaredy cat when it comes to scary movies?
I'd like to think that I'm not, but I don't go fishing for the scary movies either.
So, yes, you are. So here's the list. The Cosmo list is better. I mean, these are just like if... Because Brenda and I couldn't think of a... What should we watch? The list is just a good reminder. The Exorcist, The Babadook, Paranormal Activity. Those are three hits right there.
I hate Paranormal Activity, but
perfect.
Yes, big hit.
The Ring is my all-time...
The Ring's very scary.
I want to watch The Ring again and see if I can get through it. A lot of times I watch it from the other room. I literally go in the other room and look around the corner.
But that's where they get you, is in the other room. That's where you get snatched.
The Shining, you know, that's, I don't even think that is such a scary movie anymore. It's just fun to look at. I feel that way about...
disagree. Strong disagree. But yeah, okay.
Silence of the Lambs is on that list.
Yeah.
I think this list is inspired because it has Black Swan on there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good movie.
You ride the line. You know, all these picks, it's like, how do you define horror exactly? Everyone's got a different definition.
That's
it's
why...
borderline stuff. But yeah, that's
okay,
a very scary
so
movie.
Jaws is on the list, and I don't think Jaws is on this list.
Yeah.
I put Summer Popcorn Thriller. I don't put Jaws on scary movie.
That's the thing. It's thriller or horror. That's the line you have to...
Blair Witch. That was one that we all just lost our minds about. Scary
I know.
Enough.
I missed the phenomenon in the theater, so I don't... totally get it.
Yeah, right.
I watched it. It just stressed me out. It didn't really scare me. I was just like, ugh.
People were running out of the theaters. They were collapsing
out. Well, people thought it was real. No, I'm serious.
God,
that was
did.
The marketing campaign. It
That's
was a documentary.
Right. That's right.
That's kind of what the phenomenon was. You can't imagine nothing like that could ever happen now.
I don't think you could pull that off today.
No
what
way.
An interesting
no way.
Point. WGN Radio News is coming up. Today is the 10th day of that CTU strike, by the way. 7 of those are school days. Athletes still can't participate. An acquaintance of mine sent me a picture at one of the regional cross-country meets, and the kids are there. They can't run. Literally, they go to soccer matches with their uniforms, stand there, and then the match is awarded to the non-CPS team because CPS cannot play now that the strike is in play. In fact, I was looking at one of the regionals, and it has like 8 teams from Chicago and then Oak Park and maybe one other town. So you, the meat has been gutted this morning because the kids literally can't run.
Well, Simeon and a couple other high schools looks like they've gotten waived to possibly get their playoff game.
My understanding is I've been following that, Joe, and I'm not real good at this. It looks to me like there's a couple of things that were going to keep Simeon out. One was that they hadn't played enough games. You have to have played 8 football games.
Correct.
And so they were somehow, my understanding was the ruling was that Simeon will be able to play if CPS allows it. But I don't think that the football playoffs are allowed for CPS schools, correct?
My understanding is IHSA will allow it if the strike ends by Tuesday.
Yes, yeah, fair enough, right.
Because then they get 3 days of practice, yep. And they'll constitute them in with 7 games played because they're 6-1. It's Simeon and then 2 other schools, Phoenix Military Academy and then one more, I believe.
You and I are on the same page then, so I think we're saying the same thing, but that doesn't do any good for the kids that would be running cross-country today
because
the strike's not over. And we've been going back and forth all week long about the fairness of that or what should happen. I've been consistent, maybe consistently annoying, but
you are fixated on the sports part of this, though, which I think is interesting. You were last week, too, when I was here on Saturday.
Yeah, I still am.
But, I mean, it is an interesting topic because, one, you're right, it shouldn't be about sports. It should be about school. But two, the kids don't really get a say in this,
and well,
it's not fair to them. And
talk to me about, do the teachers have a right issue about the libraries and the teachers' assistants? Yeah, I'm on board that. I mean, that's a conversation I'm not having with you right now. Can't I say both things?
I don't know. I just think that when people strike, they do it for a reason, and it's painful.
I get that. That's,
you know, and that this is part of that. You know, I don't think anyone would say we don't want the kids to play, and good riddance to their teams or whatever. It's just like this is part of it. It's a painful process,
right? Sports must suffer for the greater good.
Okay, but this whole thing started in January, right? I mean, they've been trading offers since January. What a coincidence that right when the school year starts and the kids want to play football and cross country and stuff like that, soccer, that's when the teachers go on strike. That's been the timeline of this thing.
So are you insinuating that it was pre-planned to be around this time to hold some like greater merit?
Well, I don't think that it holds greater merit, but I think it sure increases the pain. You're darn right. More painful than not being able to run in the cross-country meet is maybe missing a week's worth of pay, and you've got bills to pay the 1st of November.
Or as a student, missing a week of school.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't, it seems like a redirect, and it's like, because there is something emotional tied to what we see, kids who want to compete. And I understand that, but it feels like sort of taking, I don't know, going around the central issue. And, you know, to what end? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think they're different conversations, because if we were just going to argue the merit of the strike, that's the conversation we've also been having. You know, I mean, like, the more I think about it, the more I think class size is an issue. Incidentally, the Mincing Rascals dove deep into that issue and others in our podcast this week. So we are sure on that topic. When you go to Mincing Rascals on your smart device, Spotify, type in the Mincing Rascals or listen to it on our website. But the Mincing Rascals do talk about that for sure. Donald Trump is in town tomorrow. He's speaking to the police chiefs, and then he's going to attend a fundraiser right across from us at the Trump Tower. That'll be, I said tomorrow, I meant Monday.
I was going to say, he's going to be at the World Series tomorrow.
Yeah. Is he really?
Yeah.
Is he going to throw out the first
pitch? He will not. Who's the chef that they don't get along with? He's going to be throwing out the first pitch?
Hey, when the governor throws out the first pitch, when the mayor throws out the first pitch, if you are a politician, even in your hometown, that is always fraught with peril. You know, I would not advise Donald Trump to throw out the first pitch, just because I can hear the chorus already. It's not a good scene. He will be in town on Monday. Then Barack Obama is in town on Tuesday to meet with his foundation. At least two groups are planning to protest the president's visit. And if the teachers are free in downtown again, that would add to the ruckus. Hillary Clinton got 84% of the city's vote in 2016. She got 56 to his 39% statewide. She won 12 counties. He won 90 counties in Illinois, to show you how divided geographically we are. At the police convention where the president is speaking, one company is going to present their wares. They make a drug detection device called Sotoxa. And this is what's going to happen maybe after the first of the year if the city or state police use these devices. Carol Stream is starting to use them. And that is, they'll do a swab on your cheek when they pull you over if they think you're impaired. And in 5 minutes, it goes into a cartridge. They have a drug profile of the stuff you've taken. The problem is, it may show THC, but you may not be impaired from use of marijuana. So there's going to be a real problem with how these devices work and what they do with that information. Think about that. They'll go, yeah, this thing shows you positive for pot. And you go, yeah. They say, well, we saw you swerve a little bit. And you go, well, I'm not impaired. I just broke the lane a little bit. You know, well, now we've got you for drugs and reckless, you know, impaired driving. But you may not be impaired. So that's going to be a problem. I say all of that to say this. The people that make that device are going to be in our studio Monday. So if you're thinking about smoking pot now or anytime after the 1st of January, you might want to hear our conversation then. Speaking of inebriation or impairment, how's the wedding planning going, Joe Brand, for you and your bride a few months from now, fiancé? Pretty well, I trust. Things are going good. The letter to Dear Abby came up on our show this week, and I just wanted, we got a lot of texts about it, and we didn't get a chance to talk about them. It says, Dear Abby, hey, are you over there, Joe Brand? You know, Griff, I got the button.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was listening to Patrick Kane say something.
What are you doing, preparing the sportscast?
I guess so, silly me.
How's the wedding planning going?
Wedding planning is going all right.
Is Patrick Kane more important to you than her?
Is Patrick Kane coming to the wedding? Now you've got a conversation.
Right now I'm thinking if she's listening right now. I think she's not. No, wedding planning's been going all right. Like I was saying earlier, things have been popping up like I wasn't expecting to. But
it's getting more expensive than you thought.
It is. Well, I mean, I knew it's a wedding. I know it's going to be a lot of money. I felt like I was pretty organized with all the finances, but now as we get closer, just these things start to pop up that you didn't really realize would be this much. And okay, all right, we got to put a little aside for that and put a little aside for that.
You don't have to share with us any details, but is there an expense that surprised you that you would like to warn people about should they get engaged in the city sometime soon?
Yes, I do. If you are planning on having a transportation system in Chicago, meaning you leave from someplace located in Chicago and arriving to someplace located in Chicago.
You're on a party bus.
Correct. And if you are in a party bus that holds 15 or more people and those 15 or more people are expecting to consume alcohol, you will need a security guard that you will have to pay for to have that whole operation going. So that's something I learned last week.
Joe, you make that money back when you put ice in the drinks.
That's not a bad idea. All right, here's your White Claw. Oh, that'll be an extra $2 for the cold White Claw.
Everybody likes their White Claw on ice. That's how it...
Nothing says fun party like a guy you don't know in a yellow windbreaker sitting next to you. Security. Who you're paying a few hundred bucks for.
That's just for your family, Joe. Most people don't have
that. Yeah, right.
Well, thanks for the heads up on that, my friend.
Absolutely. And just anything I can do to help the greater good.
Dear Abby, my friend Nan is planning her wedding and asked if I, along with our friends, would be bridesmaids. Fast forward a few months, the bride-to-be is now pregnant. We're having our first get-together as a bridal party. She wants only non-alcoholic mocktails for our girls' night in. I asked the maid of honor, would it be okay if we could have the option of alcohol? And she said no, because that's what the bride wants. Is it rude to drink in front of a pregnant bride? I'll honor Nan's wishes, but I'd like a second opinion. Should this no alcohol policy be in effect for all pre-wedding events? How about the shower? How about the bachelorette party? I don't know if you've run into this out there, but when I've mentioned that, we got a lot of texts about it.
Sounds like somebody doesn't want to pay for a security guard.
I'd say if she doesn't want you to drink, at least at this one thing, maybe if it extends to the entire wedding, that's maybe different. But
it's going
to
be a short reception.
Well, at the wedding, you absolutely, and you can do whatever you want, I guess. But I think no, a dry wedding is tough. I think if she, if at her like side of the wedding prep things, if she doesn't want drinking, it's because she's pregnant. I think that's fine. If all of her friends get trashed and she's just sitting there, that's not fun.
No, I guess right. But a couple of glasses of Chardonnay, to me, the bride ought to be able to muscle through that.
Is that that's what it takes for me to get trashed. I don't know.
Well, 630 said wrong. It's the bride's party. She says no booze, then it's no booze.
That's where I'm at.
Okay, but this one from Wheaton, Aaron says, I'll be bringing a flask to all the wedding events, if that's the case. 815 said, wait, bride's day, parties, affairs, if you can't live without liquor, don't go. Or sneak it. 6-3, which I suppose they'll kind of do.
That was a very principled stance until the end.
Until those last two words. 630, if you can't be social and have fun without alcohol, you might have a problem. 269 said, I wouldn't be able to handle my family without alcohol. And then three alcohol glass emoticons right afterwards, or emoji. Mark says, for the bachelorette party that will be alcohol-free because the bride is pregnant, does that mean the attendees need to have morning sickness, too, and crave ice cream?
Good God.
You're drilling down further on this than I did.
It's a good point.
630 said, for the dry wedding, bring a flask. 269, if her friends can't attend their friends' wedding activities while sober, then maybe they're the ones with the problem. And finally, I was at an AC/DC concert at the United Center a few years ago, and there was no alcohol. I guess most, if not all, of the band were recovering alcoholics, and they requested no alcohol served at the United Center. And we were in a suite, still couldn't get alcohol. We knew it beforehand, so we snuck some in. Sneaking some in seems to be a theme here. John, have you ever been out where everyone is drinking besides you? 2 to 3 drinks and people start talking over each other. 3 to 5 drinks, everyone is talking loud. No one is listening anymore, just talking and laughing at nothing. Maybe that's the scene that the bride doesn't want.
I was so on board with... yes, let your friends drink even though you can't. And then Griffin said the situation where all her friends are trashed and she's just there thinking about her being pregnant, not being able to drink. And that takes a total 180 on that party.
Yeah,
I was right about that. Thank you, Joe.
Well,
I think what we've learned here, she should, for her wedding shower, go to an AC/DC concert.
A guy called in yesterday or a couple days ago on our show, and he said that his buddy, he was the best man at a wedding. And the mother of the bride said, I'll pay for everything. No alcohol.
Wow.
No deal.
I'm talking the reception.
That is brutal.
It's the dream location. It's whatever they wanted. I don't know if it's the golf course or the club, but whatever it was they wanted, she paid for the whole thing. No booze.
And did they do it?
So it was no booze, he said, but they threw a tailgate party in the parking lot. The and she was, and they had three kinds of lemonade that you could choose from. She finds out that they're tailgating, and she was ticked. But what are you going to do? That's a tough call. I was at a Salvation Army wedding. It was lovely. It was gorgeous. The music was fantastic. You know, if you know going in, hey, it's going to be a dry wedding. It's, you know, you can live that way, but you just kind of need to get your mind right so that you don't feel like the rug got pulled out from underneath you. You're thinking, hey, we're going to have a great time. Our friends will be there. We'll be dancing. We'll have some wine. No, you're not.
You know how you get your mind right.
No, I don't.
Tailgate in the parking lot.
Here's my number, 312-981-7200. Maybe you've been to this situation. I'm wondering what your comment or experience was. 312-981-7200. Call me now. Hey, Kathy, it's John. You're on WGN. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, John?
I'm well. What did you want to say?
My husband was in AA, and I wasn't. I drink very, very little. And we went to an AA dinner dance. There were probably 250, 300 people there.
What a nice
all
idea.
Having a wonderful time with no booze. And I wanted a drink. There was something so odd about the situation that I was uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was strange.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, you know, listen, abuse of alcohol is a bad thing, and alcoholics should not drink. So this is not my point. But used responsibly, alcohol can loosen a person up at a dance.
Sure.
It can
sure.
be enjoyed. So
and
then you...
it made me tense.
I'm sorry to hear that. Kathy, thanks for the call.
Sure enough. Bye, John.
Have a good day. Hey, Scooter, you're on WGN. What's on your mind?
Hey, John. How you doing, John?
Good,
John,
man.
I got a good friend of mine, Irish family, went to the wedding and jollied at the mansion. And the son was in AA, 24 years old, had a problem.
Yeah.
AA. I respect that.
Yeah.
But my point is, if they respect and had a dry wedding, but my point is your guest should be able to have a drink of wine or a drink. That was my point to his brothers, which I've known all my life.
Yeah.
And they just shrug their shoulders. But that's, you know, they honor the, because he's an AA, doesn't mean the rest of the party. It's a party for a wedding, for a celebration, where they should honor their guests. You know, instead of everybody was not really happy about the situation, my point is, you know.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I mean, you know, if you're throwing a party, you're throwing it for the other people. So if you,
yes,
if you
got to honor your guests, your friends and stuff, and a bunch of us were like talking, like, I know we understand he had a problem. He's an AA. We all get that. But just, you know, your guests should be able to enjoy themselves with a glass of wine or a drink if they want.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. That's the yin and the yang of it. Scooter, thanks for the phone call. 11:09. Thank you, Maple. This is John Williams. Listen for me weekdays from 1 to 3 here on WGN. It's good to hear that the teachers in the union in Chicago weren't hurling so many invectives at each other Thursday and Friday. They're meeting again today, and the smart people in a story in the Chicago Sun-Times today say that if the two sides in any negotiation are being quieter in the public, then it means they're getting more done in private. So maybe very soon, maybe Monday, let's be optimistic, we'll have some sort of breakthrough. They are meeting today. And the Mincing Rascals were talking about the teacher strike. Wherever you listen to podcasts, listen for the free Mincing Rascals. You could even just say, play the Mincing Rascals podcast to your smart speaker and there the latest episode will be. In our latest episode, you'll be able to hear Heather Sharone from The Daily Line, Austin Berg, the co-author of The New Chicago Way, a great book about the way things get done in Chicago. I'm sort of moderating the panel, as always. Steve Bertrand and Eric Zorn were away this week, but Lisa Donovan was there, too. She writes The Spin, and that's a daily newsletter for the Chicago Tribune. And Lisa described the peril for Lori Lightfoot if she sits down at the bargaining table. She's likened it to Barack Obama going to the pitch meeting for the Olympics several years ago, and Chicago doesn't get it. It looks bad. What would it mean if Lightfoot actually sat down at the bargaining table and then struck out?
It could show a lack of power if nothing gets done and she shows up.
Well, and more if more candidates like Elizabeth Warren start swinging by and saying, I stand against this, you know, progressive
did
mayor.
She help
that
her?
Doesn't help.
Whose cause did she help when Elizabeth Warren came into town shrieking her support of the
shrieking?
Teachers?
I'm here to stand with every one of the people who stand for our children every day.
Shrieking?
That sounds pejorative, doesn't it? Maybe it is. I don't think that she's vested enough in this issue to really have an opinion that matters to me. She was just using the teachers as a prop.
Well, I think, too, this was a little bit of political payback, in my estimation. Lightfoot was interviewed by the New York Times, which had a pretty big story about how Warren seemed to be sort of coming up in polling and fundraising, but she had not captured the imagination or the support of big city mayors and Democratic governors. And Lightfoot kind of, she didn't pull any punches. She questioned whether Warren could be somebody who could capture the Midwestern votes that Trump did in 2016. And she just wasn't sure that she could win the thing if she was the nominee. And so I think Warren was feeling a little bit sore about that and thought, okay, you may not support me, but look at all these people who are. Look at this union support and these people cheering around me.
I believe it is time in America to make a new investment in public education.
Yeah!
And I got a plan. plan for that.
I didn't think of that story. That's a good point. But isn't that kind of petty for a presidential candidate to spend time on and fly in and do that?
And even remember that, having read it, remembered it, and then said, I know. And then the teachers throw out the red carpet for, I guess, if Elizabeth Warren wants to stand with him, they don't suffer for that. But
she's a front runner. I mean, why not? This is she's bringing the spotlight. And with that spotlight comes the TV cameras who zoom in and show that this new mayor doesn't have control over things.
Well, one last thing. What about the parents on all of this? I talked to one the other day, but that was more because her son isn't going to get to play in the state finals in soccer. But what are we hearing from the families, from the parents themselves?
Well, I live in a neighborhood with a lot of CPS parents, and I think this is becoming more difficult as the days go by. The kids are home. I think one neighbor has a daycare, so has been able to sort of do some extra duty, but has to watch that because of licensing issues, right?
We had a third grader walk through our offices yesterday, and with her dad, you know, just trying to make ends meet on a day-by-day basis.
So I think it's getting difficult. We had a story today in the Tribune about how a lot of these camps that would sort of be help out while the kids are out of school, they're full. Everything's full. So there's not a lot of options. People might be using up their holiday vacation, of their annual vacation.
Didn't the mayor say, or Janice Jackson told us, you the schools will still be open if you want to bring your kids to school,
For a few hours, but not
all day.
And there are no after school.
It's not a daycare,
And there's a very small percentage of kids who have been showing up to the open school building.
Right, which is interesting. What do you guys think explains? I saw that same thing. It was only like 6,000 students or something had showed up at the buildings.
Well, I think there's a lot of concern about supervision for the kids. Right. You know, you've got central office staff essentially being reassigned to watch those schools. And I imagine that some parents are a little bit leery about, you know, sort of in that sort of, you know, not normal situation.
And one of the teachers I talked to said that their school not only has a lot of kids who use public transportation, they use a bus to get in a lot of cases, like a school bus, but also that they serve as sort of a place where kids can catch school buses to other schools in the city. And so I don't think those are available. Those services are available right now to them. And so people who may not have a car that they can zip their kids to school, that's a thing too.
And communication is clearly a problem, as we've been talking about on all of that stuff, which the uncertainty is what is really difficult. One of my close friends, Joe O'Cool, who is a math teacher in Englewood, who was also profiled by Kristen McQuarrie in the Tribune, and he was on a couple of news broadcasts this week because he went to school during the one-day strike in 2016, was expelled from the union, and for going to work. He coaches a chess team there at Earl STEM Academy, and it's been packed every day with new kids because parents just want their kids to go somewhere and learn something. And I'm thinking of all of the kids there who don't have a Mr. O'Cool.
One more thing about Chicago, just we didn't get to this when we were talking about the budget. Any strong feelings about the increase in tax on ride shares going from 78 cents to $3 if you take a solo ride downtown?
I was surprised at how direct the mayor took aim at the ride hailing companies in her speech.
The Tribune story said she reserved her harshest words in all of this for Uber and Lyft.
She said that they had been given free rein under Mayor Emanuel, which I thought was, you know, just a
shot at his brother.
Exactly.
Right, it was a way for her to sort of back.
But, you know, what's interesting is that we were talking with Alderman Anthony Bill, who has long been a critic of ride hailing and has long been supported by the taxi industry. And he said, look, I have been targeted by the ride hailing companies. I wish the mayor luck because they are going to go and are going full speed ahead to defeat this tax increase. And it's going to be a huge fight. And I think the mayor has opened herself up to criticism that the tax will fall heavily on people who live on the South and the West Side at the same time that she's sort of promising to introduce a new equity focused framework. Because if you're somebody who lives in Austin, you're not going to be able to get a cab. And if you've got to get downtown to the Loop, you're going to pay a triple tax on what it would cost today. So
that's
an issue.
That's what Uber Sober's line is. I was in Lawndale last weekend for Open House Chicago, and I was talking to this just came out, and the three residents were actually chatting about it. They had no sympathy whatsoever for ride hailing. They said that these are, or for the cab companies and the medallion issue, which is a whole separate thing, by the way. But no sympathy, because they say that these companies are not coming to their community. That they're still sort of there's a transit desert, and that they're part of that. So there's not a lot of sympathy.
I hadn't thought about that. If I'm in Austin and I want to get downtown, and if I'm not taking the CTA, I'm probably not going to find a cab. There's a long wait time for my Lyft to get to my place.
Correct. That was their point. That was their point. And that sometimes
I believe that.
Yeah. There, I've heard from some people. I hadn't really considered it. I heard from some other people who said, hey, this is sort of part of what should be part of an environmental issue, too, of having all of these cars drive single fares into town. This should be pushed as sort of an environmental thing.
The financial consideration for people on the South and West Side notwithstanding, if we had fewer Uber and Lyft driving around the city, it would be better, right? Environmentally, congestion-wise. Heck, they're going to have that congestion pricing if you bring a car into the city of any stripe from outside of town, maybe in a year or two. They're sure looking at that.
Well, and we learned today that CTA ridership has fallen again, and that is clearly a contributing factor that the city, you know, sort of has to run the public transportation system, but fewer people are choosing it because it's more comfortable perhaps to just, you know, get into a nice car.
I like the CTA. I mean,
take it every day.
By the way, I do too. And sometimes I wait three trains before I can get on. It's so freaking packed. I don't love that. They've got to fix some of these issues.
Absolutely. They need to tie this in with a bigger picture transportation plan.
I totally agree with that.
I know it sounds pie in the sky. Create more lines that get to more parts of the city,
more
east-west.
Yeah. Well, it just needs to be comprehensive instead of a scattershot. So to Heather's point, which I agree with, this is raising $30
million?
$40 million. And you're going to pick a fight with two very, very politically influential companies over $40
million?
There's other ways to get
$800
million. When you need $800 million.
But I'm sorry, it's not a fight worth fighting. I mean, don't you think that there's some... Don't you hate Uber and Lyft cars that stop in the middle of everywhere, including green lights, and just wait or let people out?
I'm a biker, so I very much appreciate that.
By the way, they hate you.
I'm also sympathetic. Yeah, exactly. They hate me, but I'm sympathetic to the Uber and Lyft drivers.
You are.
I don't know if I agree with this.
By the way, you guys at the Illinois Policy Institute have been studying red light cameras and reported last week. Maybe you saw this man on television. I saw him on Channel 2. Were you on all of
Such
the TV stations?
Yeah, most of the
you
local
good.
Broadcasts.
You were very soundbite friendly, which is
you guys
so
have taught me everything I know.
So important. So I have some of your findings in front of me, but you can do this better than I can. Red light cameras have taken in more than $1 billion since 2008. Billion with a B, you remind me. They're going to be doing this in the suburbs, but in Springfield, they're actually talking about banning red light cameras. Red light cameras bad?
Red light cameras very bad. So the study was the first one to look at, and Tribune has done amazing reporting on red light cameras for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
This was the first one to look at cameras comprehensively outside the city of Chicago, which we thought would be easier, but the state of Illinois keeps no list of where red light cameras are. So we had to go to every single municipality in the state and say, do you have red light cameras? How many? How much did they make? And that's where we got that $1 billion figure. The other reason that I think that popped in the media was because we're seeing in these federal indictments, Safe Speed is involved. And, you know, Cook County Commissioner Tobolsky, his chief of staff, had a contract with Safe Speed. He was literally getting cuts on a per ticket basis.
This is part of the federal investigation you're talking about. So the whole system is corrupt because it's in Illinois.
Because, well, I think red light cameras in some sense are going to be inherently a vehicle for corruption just because of the nature of the tool. But yeah, it doesn't help that it's in Illinois.
But what's bad about this? Why red light cameras bad? I mean, corruption notwithstanding.
So one is corruption.
It's generating revenue. And the revenue is predicated on people breaking the law.
So,
if we have people breaking the law to the tune of $1 billion over 8 years in the state, then maybe we ought to capture $1 billion.
So the reason that red light cameras are becoming way less popular nationally, the number of communities with red light cameras is down 35% since 2012 across the nation. But in Illinois, it's way up. So the reason being, one, constituents hate them because they feel like they're not being treated fairly. It's the rolling right-hand turn that was totally safe. A woman reached out to me saying, I took a right-hand turn to avoid getting hit in the bumper, and I got a $100 ticket for that. people hate them and tell their elected officials that they hate them. They also, there's lots of evidence, especially in Houston, that they increase traffic accidents because people slam on the brakes. So it's actually, instead of a safety benefit, it can actually cause more accidents.
Where is the city or state then heading on that? You say,
take outside the city of Chicago. In 2008, we went from 83 cameras to 2018 being over 300 cameras. So just as many as in the city of Chicago, which has more than any other big city by far. So yeah, down in Springfield right now, you have bipartisan legislation saying these things are bad. Let's ban them. Other states have done that.
That's Austin Berg. Kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? Red light cameras make it actually less safe, says he. It's 11:22. That's from the Illinois Policy Institute. Their study is there. We are about 8 minutes away from pregame coverage of Blackhawks hockey.